Good evening, everyone. I am your host, Jason Miles, here for another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you are new to the channel, please like and subscribe. If you're enjoying what you see, make sure to hit that notification bell so you are alerted whenever we go live, because we're constantly adding new episodes and doing cross streams with other channels and adding additional programming. As you can see, I'm not in my usual studio. Technological issues have caused the regular TIR live studio that I broadcast out of to be shut down for a bit. So I'll be doing the show from other locations for a while. We will be going to the exclusive champagne room, where I'll be joined by my trusty comedic co-pilot, MT. So if you want access to the champagne room and you'd like to be in the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour, there, of course, is only one way. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. If you don't want to deal with a monthly subscription like Patreon and still want to show support, drop a super chat, a super thanks, share the show with people. That gesture goes a very long way. Also, for you audio listeners, Apple is offering a subscription service. So if you're enjoying the show from the audio only format and you don't want to figure out Patreon, well, you can have access to the champagne room by just clicking that subscribe if you listen on Apple. Tomorrow I will be taking over White Guy Wednesday. If I had my soundboard, I would press yay. I'll be taking over White Guy Wednesday again and doing a Pop Life episode with actress Diane Franklin, who some of you may know from her, from my favorite movie that she's in, probably one of my favorite movies of all time, Better Off Dead. She, of course, is in Amityville Horror 2, Terror Vision, The Last American Virgin, a plethora of films. We will talk about that. We'll talk about her time in Hollywood, coming up in the 80s, being able to avoid the pejorative moniker of being in the Brat Pack, and so much more. Should be a good time, so make sure you check that out. We'll be going live at the regular time, 6 Pacific. So now that we got that out of the way, let's get to the good stuff and bring on the guests and my co-host. Please welcome the man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the resident Black angry man of Miami. Please welcome Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. I don't know why you tried to see me as the angry Black man. I am not the angry Black man. I'm just the angry man. So
I don't even think you're that angry, because you're kind of goofy, if anything. But I think people think you're angry. And I'm just going to play up the faux anger.
I'm not a smiley kind of guy. That's not about
anger. You actually are kind of smiley. You're kind of a smiley guy.
I mean, I laugh. I chuckle. I'm funny. Ha ha. You know.
Whenever, look, there's too many episodes to count where if it's, oh God, especially if it's a music episode, it's Cheddar's all day long with Pascal Robert. So I don't.
Yeah, man.
I don't know where people get this notion that you are just angry all the time. Maybe it's just good marketing on my end. I don't know.
Yeah.
I won't complain. No, not at all. I won't complain.
But you're looking very, very, very smooth in your patio.
Well, first of all, the smoothness is just sunscreen, as the sun is blaring on me. And this is like the best angle, so you don't see my water reserve and mop. But this is kind of a wonderful place to live. As you know, I love living in Mexico. And this is where our good friend and our guest good friend and co-writer for some of his books, Ben Burgess, came and would write most of his articles. He would just hit me up and be like, hey, I'm coming over to do some writing. And he would stay here till the sun went down and write a lot of articles. It's a great place to organize your thoughts, I think.
Wow. That sounds phenomenal. Maybe I need to move that whole place to like where I am in South Florida.
Or you can move your hole behind here.
Yes, interesting.
I'm so naked without the soundboard.
The soundboard is crucial.
Isn't it? It's like a part of who we are. But let's get into our show today, since, you know, we only have an hour with our guest. The political right and equality, probably two things that most people don't think go together. But 2016 was a banner year for everyone to realize the failure of liberal democracy. Bernie Sanders' presidential run allowed words like socialism and Marx to no longer be taboo. But where there was a growing awareness of leftist traditions and an interest in learning about theory, we can't deny the rise of right-wing thought. Trump was one of the many leaders that came to power that were over the top in their desire to be authoritarian leaders. While Trump was more bluster than the actual aspiring fascist dictators, the same can't be said about Duterte in the Philippines, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Orban in Hungary, and the list goes on. The political right may not be in the White House at the moment, but their ideology is dominant in many of the high courts and state houses in places like Florida, where Pascal is, and Texas. Democratic cities are being forced to take more right-wing positions on crime and education. To understand how to begin to fight the right, we should first probably understand where their anti-modernity stance comes from and why its popularity is growing. To discuss this further, please welcome professor, lecturer, author, and I feel very confident saying this, friend of show, Matt McManus.
Look, guys.
It's not the same without the applause, right?
Yeah, it's great to see you guys again, though. I got to say, though, Jason, that has to be the most fucking incredible background I've ever seen in any of these shows I've ever done. Like, every time I look at you back there, I think, like, man, he's either like a Bond villain or he inherited like some rich old lady's money and he's just living on an island.
That was true. I want my cut.
No, I'm none of that. I'm just a dude that rents a nice apartment here in Mexico.
Oh, yeah, but like fucking that view right there is envy inducing. Like, just look at it. You got the beach, you got the sun, the beautiful blue skies. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't buy that kind of view, right? That's just something that, you know, your soul's got to be in the right place.
Can you believe this, Pascal?
Someone said Jason is running the Soros headquarters.
Oh, see, I told you guys, Pascal laughs.
That was, you don't understand how rich that was. I was like, yo, is Soros breaking off checks like that? What's up? Can a brother get some ink on his?
Yeah, I know, like that. Every time somebody fucking writes to me and they're like, you fucking liberal elite, how dare you fucking say this stuff? I'm like, hey, listen, if George Soros wants to cash me a check, he's welcome to do so anytime. I'll say my act out loud online. And if he's willing to get that shit here for tomorrow, I got lots of bills to pay and I don't got nearly the amount of money I need to pay them all.
I brought you up. I was on Ben's show last week. We did a live in studio thing in San Diego and I brought you up and I was like, Ben, you and McManus and I think who else is the only glutton for punishment? Maybe a little bit of Nathan Robinson. You guys read so much right-wing literature that to me it's just like punching yourself in the nuts with brass knuckles.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, you know what's really weird? I'm writing a book right now on the history of socialism, liberal socialism in particular, talking about people like Marx, talking about people like Charles Mill, W. Du Bois. And like my wife was sitting there. She's like, this has to be the first time I've seen you read a whole bunch of books that weren't like trash fire in a long time. Like, where's all the stuff that like just makes you want to throw that across the room? And I'm like, I know, I've been in a good mood. I feel like I'm in a healthy place. You know, mentally, my mind is a lot more clear. I don't know what's wrong with me. Right? I need to go back to my Thomas Sowell's and all my weird pseudo-fascist bullshitters, right? Just not saying without them.
This is a serious question. Does it seep into your thought? Because you are absorbing a lot of it. Does some of that, you also are a person that isn't, I don't want to say you're not on Twitter because you are, because you do write all this anti-right literature that a lot of the right-wing people do kind of attack you from time to time. But when you and I exchange stuff on Twitter, it's always about music or toys.
or movies or something. So does this stuff ever seep into your thought process actually and kind of change maybe the way you were seeing the world originally?
You know, most of the time, no. I mean, I maintain a pretty clear schedule. You know, I work for a couple hours, you know, a day. You know, I try to take, you know, Friday, Saturdays off. You know, Friday I have a couple beers, that kind of thing. So there's kind of a limit to it. Really, the only time it does start to become a bit of a problem is when people say bullshit things about my family. I mean, people can say bullshit things about me all they want, whatever, right? I have a negative value that I attribute to most of their opinions, so it doesn't bother me. But somebody wants horribly racist things about my wife. They found a picture of her, and they started putting Nazi crap to me about it. That was a line that, you know, I had to draw because that really pissed me off. So things like that, yeah. But other than that, you know, it's a job. You know, you do it, crack a beer, you go home.
See,
I feel you,
Matt,
on that.
Matt got some of that. You talk about my mama, you done energy.
No, I think we all have to have lines, right? We all have to have lines that we cross. And I think, you know, as I've been doing this now, this is the fourth year we've been doing This Is Revolution. And I, you know, kind of peeled back a little bit about, you know, sharing pictures of my kids. It's just, I feel you on that. I feel you on that. Not one to expose certain aspects of your your family. That being said, my co-host Pascal Robert has a bevy of questions for you and your book. Pascal, go for it.
Yes, Matt, Comrade McManus. You know, I enjoyed your book. First of all, congratulations on your book.
Thanks, buddy.
2024 copyright, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of when it was set to come out. But I had the first question I really would like you to do, if you can. For our audience, because your book is so comprehensive, can you trace the philosophical origin of the contemporary extreme right going back in a timeline to its Aristotelian origins, to its Nietzschean origins, Burkean origins, and explain how they actually coalesce in terms of ideology? I know that's a big question, but I know you can handle it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really what the book is setting out to talk about, right? So what I do at the very beginning of the book is I try to lay out my typology. And one of the key questions in the book, of course, is what does it mean to be on the right? How do we say that somebody like, say, you know, James Fitzjames Stevens or James Bush is on the right? Or George Bush. And so is, you know, Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, all that stuff. Yep. Tough question. And what I argue is that actually F.A. Hayek got the diagnosis of what it means to be on the right correct. Not often that I say that, but it's true. Where he says that to be on the right is to be committed to this idea that there are recognizably superior or demonstrably superior people in a society. And these demonstrably superior people are entitled to more or less everything, right? More power, more status, certainly more political influence. And one of the biggest problems in our society from the standpoint of the political right are egalitarian movements focused on equality that say, no, actually, there aren't recognizably superior people. Or even if there are people who are better at this or better than that, it doesn't matter that their lives go any better than everyone else's. And of course, everyone on the right has a different vision of what it means to be a so-called recognizably superior person. And that really frames the conception of society and the conception of politics that they'll adopt. So, you know, you brought up Edmund Burke. For Edmund Burke, recognizably superior people are supposed to be set by traditions, right? And this is why he'll defend the aristocracy, which he sees as embodying certain kind of virtues and characteristics that are necessary for the preservation of the ancien regimes of Europe at the time. But, you know, you can flash forward, and Nietzsche has a very different conception of what a recognizably superior person is. Also aristocratic, but his aristocracy is supposed to be newer, tougher, and more cruel in a lot of ways than the older aristocracy. Because Nietzsche thinks that the old aristocracy, including people of his own era, like Otto von Bismarck, were just completely incapable of holding back the tide of egalitarian and especially socialist reform in Germany. So, you know, you needed tougher people in order to accomplish that. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on. But if you scratch it very far beneath the surface, I would argue that this is the kind of fundamental inclination that you'll see that makes someone right wing.
That's a fascinating conclusion, that the belief in almost kind of, I wouldn't say genetic, but a natural hierarchy based on the betterness of your humanity and superiority of others is fascinating. One of the things you highlight in your book that I was interested in, I think it's actually in the foreword, is that particularly the Nietzschean manifestation of this conservative ideology is connected to the belief that Christianity weakened Western civilization. All right, in other words, Nietzsche's idea is that the Christian notion of that we are all equal and one before God, and the only better than the other is in righteous deeds. He argues that that kind of egalitarian messaging, which we know goes back to the adoption of Christianity by the Europeans with the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD and so on and so forth, that the adoption of Christianity by the Roman Empire is the beginning of the fall of Western civilization. Can you discuss that for us, please?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is one of the most controversial things that I talk about, because a lot of people like Nietzsche. And you know, whenever I get angry emails about this, I always write back and I'm like, hey, listen, I'm interested in Nietzsche also. I had a whole essay collection on him. He's a big part of this book. I'm not sitting there trying to cancel Nietzsche or anything, but let's be clear on what Nietzsche actually believed, right? Nietzsche was fundamentally opposed to the left with every fiber of his being. Nietzsche even said that he wasn't an individualist, which he's often characterized as in The Will to Power, because he says individualists are concerned with everyone's flourishing. My philosophy is concerned with what he called rank ordering, right? Ordering people according to their rankings. And later on in a letter with a Danish fan, essentially, you know, his thought thinking was characterized as aristocratic radicalism. And Nietzsche responded saying, this is a delightful or very good way of characterizing what I'm thinking about. So what does aristocratic radicalism mean for Nietzsche? Aristocratic radicalism means overturning what he sees as the millennia-long corrosion that Christianity and Christian ethics has wrought in Western civilization. And that's a complicated thing for him, and I'm not going to be able to summarize it in all of its riches here. But he basically says, look, Christianity emerged out of a slave morality, the morality of the, you know, subordinate classes. And sometimes I'll reconnote this in a racial way also. I mean, race, Nietzsche wasn't above racism, not at all. And he'll say, listen, the slave class would look up on the masters and covet their power and covet their status. But they weren't brave enough to actually overcome the masters, because that would involve violence and put their life at risk. So instead, what they did was something remarkable. They took their feelings of envy and they took their feelings of ressentiment and they creatively turned them into slave morality, right? And slave morality basically inverted the moral system of the masters, where the masters said, you should be proud and wealthy and successful. The slaves said, you should be humble, forgiving, and look after the least among us, because it's the least among us that are the children of God. And over time, this became attached to various kinds of Christian metaphysics, especially drawing very heavily from Plato, and became the kind of foundational way of looking at things in the Western world from a moral standpoint. And Nietzsche says this goes through a lot of different evolutions over time, but ultimately, liberalism, socialism, democracy, anti-abolitionism also, all of these aren't breaks from Christianity. They're the secularized forms that Christianity takes in a kind of post-God world. Since what's occurred with people like Kant or with Marx or with John Stuart Mill's is all these people say we can't have Christian metaphysics anymore. We can't believe in, you know, a great God in the sky that ordains that all people are equal under his throne. But we can still hold on to the essence of Christian morality, this idea that all people are equal by nature, or all people are equal, you know, deontologically in terms of their rights, or all people need to be factored into equally into utilitarian calculations. And Nietzsche again says, we need to chuck this whole notion of equality, reject what he calls the lie of equality of souls, and turn to a more aristocratically radical kind of system that ranks people according to, well, Nietzsche's own personal preferences, which are very extreme.
You know, I mean, one of the things that I've really found fascinating is that, like, Nietzsche coming out of Germany and coming out of these countries that were all basically dominated and pillaged by the Roman Empire. I was like, is he aware of like how the Romans looked at these inferior? It doesn't seem like his calculation of European history, forget about the history of the other you know, brown people of the world, but how in European history, like, this notion was used to impress, to impose, you know, oppression on most Europeans during the Roman Empire. You know, the idea that, you know, the superior people and all this other stuff. But I think that, as twisted as Nietzsche is, I mean, one of the things I found fascinating that you elucidated in your book as well is that his definition of success is a civilizational view, in that what defines success is the societal ability to create a society or civilization that has institutions that live for millennia to be marveled upon. For example, he talks, you know, talk, the book talks about the Egyptians. In other words, Nietzsche is saying is that if we don't live in a civilization that can create things like the Egyptians or the Romans or the Greeks, we're not worth living as human beings. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nietzsche probably talks about this most extensively in Beyond Good and Evil, right, where he summarizes his view of an ideal society. And he lays out his way of evaluating what makes a good society and what makes a bad society, particularly in the middle of the book. And he says, listen, a great culture or a great civilization or a great society is one that accomplishes extraordinary things. But he says we know what needs to go into a great society that will accomplish extraordinary things. It needs to be a society where the aristocracy is given tremendous amounts of power and tremendous amounts of liberty to do whatever it needs to do, right? And that's also going to require them to actively oppress the lower orders because that will allow them to have more leisure time so that they can pursue these kind of more higher order activities. And also because the slave class might be necessary as a kind of clay that can be molded by the superior person, including through violence, in order to execute their extraordinary projects. And again, Nietzsche is not above defending slavery in very emphatic terms in order to advance this kind of position. So, for instance, in both The Antichrist and in Twilight of the Idols, he talks about, listen, the biggest problem with Germany right now is Otto von Bismarck, you know, famous progressive that he is trying to give the lower orders a certain degree of education so that they can more effectively participate in German politics, more effectively, you know, fulfill the role, their roles in an industrial society. And Nietzsche says that's ridiculous and stupid. You should be educating the lower orders of German society to be a slave class. And if you don't educate them to be a slave class, why are you surprised that all of a sudden many working class Germans are deciding that they want to vote for the Socialist Party of Germany? Because of course they are, right? So don't bother with that. Let the slaves be the slaves and let the lords be the lords. And it's an extraordinarily radical view, but one that he thinks is necessary in order to produce the kind of grandiose and exemplary societies and exemplary cultures that he sees as necessary in order to affirm life politically.
What's funny, fascinating, is that I saw Andy William made a comment. I know this is like kind of slander of Nietzsche, but I'd like to bring it up. He said it's funny because Nietzsche today will be considered an incel.
Not I to saw that.
Can we talk about, I mean, I'm a firm believer that psychology kind of motivates philosophy, but wasn't Nietzsche kind of infirmed in certain ways that made him kind of, you know, question his capacity to perform in certain ways? Like, please, can you discuss that, please?
Yeah, we can. I mean, that's a really tough question since we don't have all the information about this. We do know that Nietzsche had at least one sexual interaction in his lifetime with a prostitute, and there's some basically speculation that this encounter might have been what gave him syphilis or might have given him syphilis, and that ultimately contributed to his fall into madness. But again, we're just speculating here. What we do know is that he had really bad relationships with women over the course of his life. So, for instance, he had one romantic encounter with a woman called Lou Salomé. He proposed to her twice. She rejected him twice and then ditched him with his friend. And it's quite funny because years later, she was talking about spending time with Nietzsche, and she had some very interesting things to say about him. Was like, clearly a genius, but her whole kind of viewpoint of him was he's just way too much, right? Thought too much of himself, way too intense. You know, I just wanted to go and have a good time. touring around Europe, and he would want to stay up late at night, didn't want to drink, didn't want to do it, just talk about philosophy and his philosophy in particular. And you can kind of get the gist of what she's getting at, right? Like, imagine being a 22-year-old woman with like a 30-ish-year-old guy who's lecturing you about how brilliant he is late into the night. It's not exactly the most endearing thing in the world. But then, you know, as a result of that and some very complicated feelings he had for his mother and his sister, he became a raging misogynist, right? There's no doubt that, you know, he consistently argued for the subordination of women, said, you know, goest thou to women, make sure you bring a whip, and thus spoke Zarathustra, and emphasized these kind of hyper-masculine values while degrading what he saw as the effeminacy or the deepening effeminacy of contemporary society, particularly through movements like liberalism, socialism, and democracy, which, again, he associated with these kind of womanly attitudes of care, compassion, that kind of stuff.
So basically, we can argue that Nietzsche was kind of a 19th century incel who was insecure about his manhood and was projecting all of this kind of masculinity in his philosophy because he felt insignificant as his capacity before.
I mean, if you want to give that reading, then by all means, go ahead. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you and say that it didn't cross my mind at points also. But, you know, I'll say this for you. You know, Nietzsche once said, you know, you should always try to read beneath the surface of a text and recognize that any philosopher put forward by a philosopher is a kind of confession on their part. So if you're reading a book about how we need these strong, ultra virile, cruel, powerful, you know, muscular supermen, and it's written by a kind of sickly, dweeby, 40-ish-year-old academic, you know, couldn't even really lecture past his 30s, you know, that could be revealing of, you know, one of the motivations behind writing that. Let's just say this, even from a Nietzschean standpoint.
It says a lot about Jordan Peterson.
Yikes.
Don't even get in there. That's a whole different kettle of worms. Yeah,
that's a different book he wrote. And, you know, Nietzsche had several girlfriends. They just went to a different school. Let's just be honest. Quit teasing that, man.
Jason, you want to pick up with any questions?
Yeah. Matt, in your book, you write, as a distinct body of thought, the modern political right emerged in response to the liberal and democratic movements of the 18th century, which they initially saw as a concerted threat to well-established political hierarchies. With the latter rise of socialism and its calls for economic democracy and redistribution of property, these disputes took on a renewed vigor that could often become deeply venomous. This responsiveness to agonism, the reactionary disposition, as it is sometimes called, means that the political right is far more eclectic than either liberalism or socialism. This is sometimes explained away as arising from theoretical differences. According to Russell Kirk, unlike liberals and socialists who are committed to abstract principles, the conservative is framed more by a disposition or attitude than anything else. In On Being Conservative, Michael Oakeshott framed it more nostalgically, claiming to be a conservative. To be conservative is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, to prefer the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the limited to the unbounded, the near to the distant, the sufficient to the superabundant, the convenient to the perfect present, laughter to utopian bliss. This preference for the familiar and actual is indeed emblematic of conservative thought, which is why they often claim to be more realistic in a very narrow way than their liberal or conservative counterparts. Matt, how do you think someone that believes that they are, in fact, the adult in the room can be kind of reasoned with when they have that type of conservative ideology that you're describing?
Well, I think it's a very difficult thing, in no small part because, and this is one of the things that I stress in my book, liberalism and socialism both emerge, broadly speaking, from the shared Enlightenment outlook. Now, obviously, liberals and socialists disagree very fundamentally on certain points, or they might agree so very fundamentally on certain points. And, you know, I'm writing a book on liberal socialism right now, like I said, which is about liberals who agree with socialists about a lot of different things. But the shared Enlightenment framework is one that's always allowed a kind of dialogue that has been fluid and sometimes contentious, but it's a dialogue. Whereas the political right, by responding very vehemently, or at least emerging in response to the Enlightenment, speaks in a very different kind of idiom and has a very different set of priorities and convictions. Because, you know, if you talk to any liberal and any socialist and you said, do you believe that people are fundamentally equal, or at least that they should be treated equally? Both of them will say yes, quite probably, right? Liberals might say equality just means equality under the law. Socialists will probably say that equality must mean something that's a little bit more substantive than that, but they'll agree with that base definition. Many conservatives would reject that, right? Even so-called moderate conservatives like, say, Barry Goldwater, and I put moderate in quotations there, right? Where Barry Goldwater was said in, or his ghostwriter did, I should say, in The Conscience of Conservative, that, listen, people are equal before God, but they're equal in no other respect. And any kind of artificial device you use to try to make them equal is only going to lead to a lot of unhappiness in the long run. So don't even bother with that. And you can find far more extreme views than this. Take, you know, for example, a major fascist author, right? Like Adolf Hitler, right? About as major fascist author as you could think of. Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf says that there is what he calls an aristocratic principle in nature, that the so-called, quote, Jewish doctrine of Marxism constantly tries to dilute or get rid of. And if it's allowed to run its course, this idea that there's an equality between races and between peoples will lead to the destruction of all life on Earth, because the superior race is, of course, supposed to triumph over all others and land at the top of the pecking order. And if it doesn't, then this aristocratic principle of nature is violated. So there's a continuity there in this conception of human inequality between somebody like Goldwater, who I want to stress is not a fascist, he's a more moderate figure, and somebody who's on the extreme right. And if somebody holds these views about human equality and about the unequal worth of individual and social human beings, it can be very difficult for liberals and socialists to have a meaningful conversation with them unless they really kind of dive in to this viewpoint and try to understand it.
I brought that question up because I recently went up to the Bay Area, and on my drive up and down, there's this one part of the I-5 that I get, my phone always dies on, so I have to listen to the radio, and it's conservative talk radio, and it's all there is. It's either Jesus in Spanish, Jesus in Farsi, or conservative talk radio, and
I mean, I'd go with the Jesus and Farsi, but, you know, you do you.
I was going with a lot of, it was kind of making me sleepy, and, you know, it's a long drive. Yeah. But as I was listening to conservative talk radio, the thing that I thought was kind of fascinating, and then, you know, reading your book, I was like, this is fascinating, because it really is a mindset that I think a lot of people that get caught up in, like, the online goings-on, which is has no bearing on like what you really see in the real world, especially in right-wing thought. They have one enemy, it seems, and that enemy, and they're laser focused on it. And that enemy seems to be, for some odd reason, Karl Marx. And it's fascinating. Pascal and I were talking about this the other day, because you, Pascal, were on a show with Katie Halper, where you guys were watching the Republican debate, right. And it was a similar thing there. They had one enemy, and it was Karl Marx as well, and this rising idea of leftist orthodoxy taking over everything from the campus to state legislatures, which is the furthest thing from the truth, as we're seeing a rollback of a lot of civil rights laws. You know, we talked about, you know, a lot about abortion on this show, and the border. It looks like right-wing thought is kind of taking over again, like we saw it take over maybe in the late 80s with the Democratic Party and the third wave Democrats. I don't know if you're seeing this. Again, Pascal and I talk about this kind of more so offline than we do on air. A direct return to a lot of the same tough on crime policies that now we probably would think that a right winger would prescribe. But this seems to be kind of the way many people think about how to solve these more complex problems. And I think a lot of it has to do with that mentality that you talk about, where I actually have the real world solutions that can fix your problem right away, whereas you're looking kind of down the road in this utopian paradise, and you don't know how to get there.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of times they're just fucking wrong about this. I had a debate about drug decriminalization not too long ago. And, you know, the person I was interlocuting with just said, why don't we just lock them up? You know, lock them up, get them, you know, straight. And then, you know, after a couple of years in jail, they'll be fine. And I pointed out that, listen, we've been trying to do that since the 1970s, you know, with Richard Nixon, and then, you know, peeking through the 1980s. And it's really telling that by the end of the Reagan Bush years, there were more people in jail in the United States than there were in the so-called evil empire, the Soviet Union. Now, that's an extraordinary fact if you think about it. Mostly blacks and other minorities, but by no means exclusively, right? Mm-hmm. And did that do anything to stop the use of drugs? No. You can contrast that, well, with, say, Portugal, right? Mm-hmm. Portugal is a country that tried out decriminalization. And by every metric that you can look at, you know, drug use, drug fatalities, crimes related to drugs, things have gotten a lot better. And there's no surprise that things have gotten better, because this is what a lot of social scientists who have actually looked into this have been saying for decades would happen if you relax the war on drugs and actually treat this as a medical problem rather than a criminal justice problem. But treating it as a medical problem involves humanizing drug users, right? Saying, like, these are people who, you know, if they're really seriously struggling with addiction, might want to get better, but they can't, and we should help them, right? And yeah, they might do shitty things that we can't, don't approve of, and they're going to have to face up to their families and their friends for doing that. But it shouldn't be society that's imposing those kind of punishments on them. They're probably going to have plenty of guilt about it when they come clean, when they get clean at the end of all this. And again, I can understand at a certain human level this yearning for simple solutions, like just lock them up. But, you know, this is one of, again, the legacies of the Enlightenment Project, right? That we know, both as liberals and as socialists and broadly speaking as progressives, that sometimes you don't just follow that instinct to say these people are worth less than me, or they're worth less than my family, or they're worth less than the people in our community. So who cares if we lock them up? You have to sit there and actually look at the evidence for the kind of policies that work and try to implement those as successfully as possible. And in this particular instance, I think it's very clear that decriminalization and treating this as a medical problem is the winning solution.
Pascal?
No, I mean, I'm not saying I disagree with you at all, but I think that the problem we have in America is that that solution may work in Portugal, but the ideological superstructure of America, from media, television, from everything else, is so rooted in blaming everyone for their misfortune of being poor. And as a result, the atmosphere in this country is based on basically saying those people deserve to be in that position. Look at how they live. You know, it's a very, this is a common philosophy you get from working class people of whatever background. It's very, very much the norm. So my question is not that will decriminalization work. My problem with the nature of American society is that I think America is such a corruptly brutal country in terms of its worldview, perpetuated not because Americans are evil as people, but the way we socialize our citizens to view our own countrymen who may or may not look like them in terms of hue, ethnicity, or otherwise, makes those kinds of solutions very precarious in this country.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I have to say that in a lot of ways, I think the kind of meritocratic individualism, so-called, that you see in the United States is more damaging than a lot of other social views that you see elsewhere. So Wendy Brown has – sorry, Jason, go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead. No, I'm listening to you.
Oh, shit. Sorry, my bad. Okay, so anyway, Wendy Brown has a really good book about this called On the Ruins of Neoliberalism. Really complicated, really smart stuff. Not going to be able to summarize it all. But long story short, she says, listen, obviously when – classical liberals like the American revolutionaries destroyed the old aristocratic order. That was a really positive benefit in terms of human equality, human emancipation, and democracy. No one's sitting there saying that that's a bad thing. But you have to give this to the old aristocratic kind of Christian order. At least, you know, when St. Thomas Aquinas or Robert Filmer, who's somebody I discussed in the book, says, listen, God has ordained you to be poor. God has ordained him to be king. You don't have to internalize blame for that. You know, you're like, listen, God has just ordained that there's going to be poor. God has ordained that there's going to be a king. But we'll all be equal in heaven. And I have my role to fulfill here on earth. And so there's kind of dignity to being poor in these circumstances that you can also see reflected in the Bible, right? The Wretched of the Earth is not just a really good title for Francis Fanon's book. It's also in the Gospel of Matthew, right? Where Jesus says, you know, the wretched of the earth will know that God's on their side. Which is a good argument for Christian socialism, I would argue, but we'll put that aside, right? What Brown says what happens in the United States is you have the formation of a society where people are nominally held to be equal, at least equal before the law. We all know that that's not true, right? People, you know, white supremacy, misogyny, you know, homophobia, all those are very real things. But she says, let's just take this idea that all people are equal at face value, but only equal in front of the law. That means that it's very easy for anyone who reaches the top to say, I got here purely based upon my own merits. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. And so I don't owe shit to the people at the bottom. They could have wound up where I am, but they didn't, you know? And that's a pretty toxic attitude. But Brown says it's nowhere nearly as toxic as what can appear at the bottom, where you have all kinds of people who are constantly told, listen, you had your shot, right? You could have made it the way that they did, but you didn't. And it's not because of God's fault and it's not society's fault. It's because you're a fucking loser, right? You just couldn't cut it. And so you belong in the gutter where you are, right? And that's a horrible thing to think about yourself. And, you know, just talking to young people, you know, in my profession, I can tell you that a lot of people feel this way if they aren't cutting it in this country, right? They think, like, what's wrong with me? What am I doing? You know, why couldn't I do better? Look at these other people who are successful. Is it because I'm just worse, right? And, you know, you can multiply that in all kinds of communities. And what Brown says is you have then a ruling class in the United States that feels like for the first time in history, it owes nothing to anyone at the bottom because it got where it got purely based upon its own virtues, and a working class, at a huge working class that is constantly told that it should feel like crap because they got where they got because they also deserved it. And she says, you add up this very toxic stew. Are you really surprised that somebody like Donald Trump comes to fore and divides the world into winners and losers and tells conservatives, you're the winners, and all these losers want to take things from you and don't let them, right? You got what you got because you deserve it and they don't deserve anything. You know, send them back home, throw them in jail, lock them up, whatever you need to do.
And it's a more dominant ideology than I think a lot of people want to believe that it is. You know, here I am, I'm from the, you know, imagined liberal bastion of California, but it's only a few counties in a very large state. And even within those counties, I don't think it's the Marxist paradise that the conservatives may want to claim it is. Because even in the heyday of the 80s and 90s, most of our, you know, like hardcore black nationalists and leftists were definitely huge proponents of increasing the police state because of what we were seeing with the homicide rates skyrocketing due to the influx of cheap cocaine. But now here we are, and we don't necessarily have an influx of cheap cocaine, but what we do have is an influx of easy to get prescriptions for addictive opiates, coupled with an extremely rising cost of living and jobs that just don't suffice. So you have a growing homeless population, kind of just a growing precarity, older citizens that have definitely just been forgotten about and thrown out because we don't know how we want to view our elderly in the West in general. Canada isn't much better on this. Nope. So when you hear people complain and then you hear the solutions, for most people, those solutions are kind of simple. If my car constantly gets broken into, you know, I'm scared when I cross the border and I don't have a nice car at all, but it's a car, it's got windows, somebody may want to bust out just for shits and giggles. That's kind of what's going on. I get the frustrations of people, but we all know the answers are not as simple as lock them up. And I've said this on the show, and I think I kind of need to say it again so we really understand. In a state like California, we were so filled with our prisons in the 2010s that the state legislature, kind of against their better wishes, had to start letting people out because people were dying. Multiple people were dying a day throughout the state prisons and jails due to inadequate health care and overcrowding. So that's when we started, you know, letting all these people out. So we don't really have the long-term view, and I don't know how to have that conversation because you have to tell somebody this isn't going to be an overnight solution to this problem. If the blight of the unhoused is something that, you know, you can't bear to witness, if people are shooting up next to your kid's school, which that is a problem in cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, we can't solve that overnight. We can begin to try, but we can't solve it overnight. It seems like the right has the immediate answer that people just want. It relieves me from this stress.
Absolutely, right? I mean, and I think there are a few different facets to this. One of them is you see somebody like Donald Trump come along who will usually claim that he respects or reflects the will of the people. Now, he doesn't reflect the will of all the people, but only the legitimate people. For the most part, you know, white elites and the white working class, but there's a little bit of wiggle room for growth there. And what's really interesting about the way that he will frame this is most of us will see usually understand democracy as entailing certain kinds of checks and balances and having a certain majoritarian quality to it. But Trump will say, no. Any kind of check or balance on my power is, in fact, a kind of anti-democratic measure because it's not allowing me to act to respect the will of the people or to reflect the will of the people. So what I need is more and more power concentrated in my hands so that I'd be able to implement this more effectively and to do what's necessary for, you know, people who are backing me up. And this is the trope, if you want, of many conservative authoritarians throughout the 20th century, going all the way back actually to white anti-abolitionists in the American South, which is a very interesting example we can talk about. But there's another way that conservatives can also try to deal with the animosities that emerge from extraordinary inequality in a country like the United States. So for instance, I just finished today Thomas Sowell's book on social justice fallacies. I'm sure everybody knows who Thomas Sowell is, right? You know, the guy of 1,000 zingers that appear on Twitter. And Sowell's argument is actually quite different than Trump's. It's not, you know, let's sit there and adopt simple solutions to big social problems, although there is some of that. It's usually just to say, listen, life sucks. Life is deeply unfair. The universe is never going to orient itself the way that you might want. So the best thing to do is just to try to eke out your living as best you can and accept the world the way that it is. And that's a longstanding bit of conservative so-called wisdom for the working classes as well. One of the most revealing statements in any conservative book is in Roger Scruton's The Meaning of Conservatism, which is a book I recommend everyone read because it's very honest. And Roger Scruton says, I really have a lot of respect for, and I quote here, unthinking people, because unthinking people are people who do exactly what Sowell tells them that people should do or says that people should do, right? Unthinking people accept the burdens that life bears upon them. Don't try to politicize them. Don't try to make them into a social problem. They go to their job. They pay their taxes. They listen to the police. And then they die and they get replaced by their kids who do more or less the same kind of thing. So that's another way that conservatives can sometimes very effectively convince people not to take action to resolve their problems, even when there might very well be social and political solutions to the issues that they face. Like I always say, if you have a crappy job working at McDonald's, like I did for a while, you can sit there and kind of stoically bear it, or you can sit there and organize a union, demand better wages, demand better conditions, and it might not fix all your problems, but it'll definitely fucking fix a few of them.
Pascal?
You know, when I hear this kind of conservative mantras, it really makes me appreciate the Haitian Revolution more and more and more. Yeah. it's incredible to me how all of these pampered little schmucks have these kind of definitive statements about humanity without evaluating how hierarchical systems that alienate particular groups of people, whether they be women, whether they be people of different ethnic groups, facilitate allowing them to rise without fear of competition for years. And then they can dictate that, well, you know, those other people couldn't succeed anyway, so we have to make sure that we preserve this so we stay on top. It's so absolutely absurd to me. And what is fascinating is that this kind of thinking has maintained salience my whole life in America, pretty much. This is why we have this thing we call the 50-plus year counter-revolution. And it's rising in America in the vulgarity of the nature in which it's being proposed to the citizenry. And it really makes me sick. So my question to you, Matt, is that is there really any possibility to create an opening? The word in Arabic for opening is fatah. You know, like, is there any word way to create a fatah, an opening in this society to really fight this kind of stuff?
You know, it's a great question, and it fucking it keeps me up at night a lot of the time, right? I tend to think that Gramsci has the formula right. What we really need is optimism of the will, pessimism of the intellect. And that's a really hard thing to achieve, and Lord knows it's a hard thing for me to achieve. But that's the kind of right balance that you want. But in terms of maybe a little optimism of the intellect, I think that there are openings, right? I always say that if you told me back in 2010, you know, right around the Great Recession, you know, coming out of the Bush administration, that by 2016, you know, you'd have a democratic socialist movement in the United States that would be winning serious political power, that you'd have hundreds of socialists a couple of years later elected into major positions across the United States. Not as many as I'd like, but at least, you know, significant ones. I would have told you you were fucking stoned and, you know, pass me whatever it is that you have, because, you know, I don't want to get in on that shit also, right? But like, yet here we are, right? And I see that as a positive sign. And I also think it's possible to be a little too America-centric sometimes. Look at the rise of people like Trump, and look at the rise of people like, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and say it's all doom and gloom. But look at Latin America, right? There's a pink wave that swept huge parts of the world between 2018 and now. I think that what Lula and AMLO are doing is really quite extraordinary in terms of rolling back the tide of right-wing authoritarianism or rolling back the tide of plutocratic authoritarianism. And that makes me a little bit optimistic. Now, do I think that they're going to change things overnight? Absolutely not, right? We know, as you pointed out, that this is going to be 10, 15, 50-year processes. But, you know, those are the kind of things that give me a little bit of hope for the future. And, you know, you never know. A lot of the Zoomers that I talk to and I teach have very progressive views, very, very pro-abortion, very, very anti-war on drugs. Also something that might signal a little bit of hope for America.
Well, I'm looking, my hope lately is coming from what I'm watching on the African continent, which I was very skeptical about at first. But, you know, sometimes you need to look at something to give you some hope. And, you know, it's an interesting observation. But there's one question I want to ask you, because your book mentions him, and I really want to talk to you about. What are your thoughts on Duganism, and how much do you think Duganism actually influences the policy of the Putin administration? And I'm going to ask a follow-up question. If Duganism and its Putin manifestation are so quote-unquote fascistic and illiberal, why is Russia as a nation having more success penetrating the consciousness of the global South than the Western liberal democratic empires and societies that once had complete control of those areas?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question. So just by way of background, Alexander Dugin, sometimes referred to as Putin's brain, is a Russian philosopher and fascist who's been active, you know, depending on when you date it, from the 1980s to the 1990s. He's had a really eclectic career, learning from, you know, white nationalists like Alain de Benoist, and, you know, synthesizing their views and giving them a bit of a Russian gloss. But just to kind of take a step back, I think it's important to kind of define fascism here, which I spent quite a bit of time in the book doing. And I think that Roger Griffin, is right in describing fascism as a kind of palingenetic ultranationalism. Palingenesis referring to rebirth, ultranationalism referring to just that, you know, this idea that the nation, so understood, is the horizon within which human beings should seek meaning. And oftentimes this has a very clear supremacist connotation, right? My nation above all, Jupiter, Uber, Alice, you know, Eurasia over the entire world, in Dugin's case. So, you know, when you read his work, it's a repudiation of the idea that Western liberalism should be hegemonic across the globe. Dugin rejects that because he sees Western liberalism as being too egalitarian, too democratic, too willing to tolerate things like LGBTQ rights, trans individuals, what he associates with postmodern relativism. And what he wants to confront this is a kind of Eurasian coalition, as it's usually called, which will have Russia at its helm, And of course, Russia will lead the new empire that is to take the place of the West. But he's also okay with allying with various kinds of fundamentalists, white nationalists. He's very explicit about his willingness to ally with them. You know, occasionally the odd Marxist, as long as they're willing to be fundamentally anti-West and not actually try to implement communism in any meaningful way. Like all fascists, he's pretty syncretic. Now, it's really hard to say how much of an influence this does have on Putin. And also part because Putin is a very enigmatic figure. Some people who I respect claim that actually he does have quite a bit of influence, that he's really kind of changed the ideological landscape in the Kremlin, and that many of the kind of higher-ups are devoted Eurasianists and Duganites right now. Other people say he's kind of a lackey or a pawn. You know, Putin drags him out whenever he needs to give the gloss of intellectual respectability to, say, invading Ukraine. And then whenever he gets a little bit too troublesome, he gets kind of put back on the shelf, his funding is stripped away, and he gets told to behave better until next time. So not, you know, being in Moscow and not being privy to all the weird backs and forths that's going on there, I can't say anything for certain. But in terms of the appeal of Putinism, I do think that it has an appeal to groups that are angry at Western imperialism and see it as deeply hypocritical that the West would feel free to police the activities of various Eurasian nations while at the same time not putting any restrictions on its own behavior and intervening wherever it is that it wants. And on occasion, one of the Putin is right. And it's a very dangerous thing to say that, but it's true. When he'll say things like, listen, the West says horrible things about our invasion of the Ukraine, but I didn't hear any of the same kind of things said when the United States decided that it was going to invade Iraq or invade Afghanistan. And all the Western nations kind of signed up on this or at least allowed it to happen. My response to that is a very simple one. You know, two wrongs don't make a right. I am absolutely comfortable sitting there and condemning Western imperialism and saying that we need to do everything we can to confront Western imperialism, whether that's being critical of it at home or resisting it abroad, while at the same time saying that that does not make Russian imperialism somehow a counterbalance or a permissible counterbalance, I should say, to what's going on. I think what's happening in Ukraine is atrocious. I don't deny that, you know, NATO provoked this intervention in certain kinds of ways, but Duganism is not the answer. Neither is any other kind of fascism, and we should be very clear that it needs to be rejected.
So you don't think the fact that the U.S. helped sponsor a coup in Russia in 2014 and put in a Russia-unfriendly leader that kind of trickled down into the politics that alienated Ukraine more from Russia had anything to do, combined with the threat of NATO expansion, had anything to do that pushed? And I'm not saying I support what Russia, what Putin did at all, but I think there's a context to what caused this invasion.
Oh, I think it absolutely did. I mean, there's no denying that Western expansion, and particularly NATO expansion in the region, was one of the catalysts for what happened in Ukraine, and one of the catalysts, I should add, for what happened in Georgia. There's a very good book about this recently from Oxford University Press called Near Abroad, where after reams and reams of social scientific and historical research, what the author found is that the Kremlin was definitely motivated by a deep fear that NATO was treading in on its home territory and felt the need to respond to that quite aggressively. It's also important to note that going back even further to like 2002, a lot of this was also preempted by the invasion of Iraq because, you know, during the kind of war on terror period, the United States adopted this hyper-militaristic posture. You know, Bush famously declared, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us, and tried to divide the entire world into those who are pro-NATO and into those who NATO might potentially take militant action against. And, you know, the policy was an absolute bust, just complete failure, delegitimized the entire idea of American interventionism, delegitimized the entire idea of, you know, a consistent or principled American internationalism. And this really opened the door for people to feel more liberated to intervene where they want because they know that the United States is not going to counteract them in any meaningful way. Now, that is not to apologize or to suggest that we should go back to the good old days of neoconservative interventionism. Not at all. It was a disaster, and it ended with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people killed. It's just to reinforce the fact that the Bush administration's calamitous decisions also contributed an awful lot to what we're seeing right now, precisely because he squandered so much goodwill and set a precedent for imperialist interventionism that other nations are now willing to exploit.
All right. Well, this has been a very...
Does that answer your question there, Robert?
Yeah, man. I respect his retort. I mean, we can back and forth, but Matt is short, concise, and to the point, man. I really appreciate when he comes on our show because he comes straight with the punches, man. He's not playing games.
That's why the right-wingers only talk to him on Twitter, not in real life, because he can speak their fast-talk language. He learned that shit reading all those horrible books.
Watching a million Ben Shapiro videos, right? You know, eventually you just start to pick up
some of that shit. I actually would love to see you engage with
some of I would love that.
Like, you know, people always ask me, why don't you debate the right wing? I said, I can't debate people I don't respect because I just want to punch them in the mouth. I don't have the temperament.
Very true.
Well, if you want, people can look up my four fucking hour debate with the distributist. Bring a lot of drinks, you know, six pack at the very least, because A, it's 4 hours, and B, this is some pretty, he's not a fascist, but you know, he's hard right, you know, traditionalist, not quite monarchical, but like aristocratic and all that stuff. I've also had debates with some libertarians. In fact, I have one that's coming up on September 22nd, I think, I'm debating Matt Swolinski, who's a left libertarian, but I got disagreements with him. People can check that out. So I'm trying to do that, right? It's just writing is where I really think my strength is.
Were you with Ben recently in Chicago? No, you weren't there for that.
No, I really wanted to go. But, you know, we're actually, my wife and I are traveling to Mexico pretty soon. So for, you know, family wedding. Now, I know I'd love to come visit Jason, but unless you're going to be in Mexico City, it's a long way away. We only ended up to pay for one trip. So I wasn't able to make it to Chicago this year.
Hey, well, I'm sorry I'm going to miss out on you guys in Mexico. Matt, thank you once again for agreeing to come on the show. His book is called, when is your book out?
Oh, it's out already. I know, Pascal, I don't understand why they fucking said it was 2024. That's a weird typo. It came out in July. People can buy it online if they want. Actually, there's a $10 discount if you buy it from the Routledge website. Still a little bit expensive, and I think it's like $38. So get it from the library if you can. But if you got $38 that you're willing to spare, consider buying a copy. And at the very least, if you buy a copy and you show it to me, I'll buy you a beer if I ever see it.
The book is called The Political Right and Equality. The author is Matt McManus. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. My co-host, Pascal Robert, thank you for joining me. You will be back on Saturday when we talk about more black people stuff with Bertram Cooper. Are you ready for that?
Sounds good.
Are you sure?
I mean, I haven't read the stuff yet, but I'll read it before we get there.
It's not about reading. It's about knowing. Do you know this black stuff? Are you ready? Are you black enough for this?
I quite frankly, I haven't even interrogated the subject matter.
You know why, people?
You're now you know. Soul searching, eh?
Now you know, people. He doesn't look at the schedule.
I saw the schedule. It's about unemployment, crime, and numbers. And stuff like
Okay.
If it makes you feel ready. Better, Pascal, I can say this now because I haven't missed one, but there have been at least a couple of occasions where Ben will message me being like, so you're on 10 minutes, you know, how you feeling? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then I'm like, oh, shit, I said I was going to appear on this thing. So like, I'll just fucking scramble. You know, sometimes I'm like wearing like sitting there. Like, my pants, I put on a shirt. You know. Nobody's figured it out yet, but like sometimes it's been real close.
Pascal hasn't worn pants in 2 years.
Good for you, man.
That's why he's so cool.
We blew past that as civilization, and it's a good thing.
Toussaint doesn't even show her face because she's just like, nah, I'm walking around like National Geographic in this house. Thank you guys for hanging out. We'll be in the champagne room. Give us like 5 minutes or so. We will be there. There's definitely some hip hop I want to go over. There's some questions I want to go over. We won't be able to have call-ins for maybe about another week until this whole computer situation gets settled and I have to stop doing shows in this beautiful terrace that I have.
Yeah. It's going to make it hard for people to even think you're working, Jason. And they're just sitting there and be like, working hard. To the guy who's living in paradise, just hanging out with his computer. No, no. You know, let me go hang out on that rooftop and then we'll see about it.
Well, thank you guys for checking this out. We will be back tomorrow night again. I'll be interviewing actress Diane Franklin of my favorite movie, Better Off Dead. If you haven't seen Better Off Dead, go watch it. It's probably John Cusack's greatest film. And on that note, gentlemen, we are
out.
Left is best.